Hello and welcome back to Powersuit Podcast. I'm your host, Lauren Ingram. I'm the founder of Powersuit Social, a creative network built for unpredictable times. This is your 1980s branded podcast. It's all about creative leaders, their careers, and their advice for how we can stay employable while things around us are changing really rapidly. Today, I'm really glad to welcome our next guest, Madison Marriage, as this is another example of me being cheeky and inviting my friends on the podcast, like I did with Hattie Jones, but only because I have talented, interesting friends. Madison gets the prize for the most deceptively boring job title. She is tax and accounting correspondent for the Financial Times, but despite the title, she's done some incredibly interesting work. She's been at the FT for several years now, and she became a household name at the beginning of 2018 when she uncovered the President's Club scandal, the secretive all-male charity dinner where women were very much treated as objects. And she's since been nominated for a Private Eye Paul Foot Award for her investigation, one of several awards actually she's been up for, and I wanted to interview her a year on from starting the investigation. So without further ado, welcome Madison.
Hello, Lauren.
This does seem overly formal for busy mates, but I'm going to ask you about your life story anyway. Okay. So, yeah, you've been at the Financial Times for a few years now, including as you were deputy editor of your section, and you're now in a new field of accounting. But can you take me back to where you first started? What was your first ever job?
Well, my first ever job was back when I was 13 or 14 working for a performing arts centre in North London as an assistant teacher. So I spent my Saturdays helping five-year-olds tap their toes and sing songs from Disney. But my first ever job in journalism was with a hedge fund magazine. And as many people say, I kind of landed there by chance. So in my last year of uni, I'd done a load of internships during my year abroad, which I did because I studied languages. And from that, I realised that I liked writing, travelling, not being stuck at a desk all day, and that I absolutely hated admin, and ideally would do something a little bit creative. And I've been putting off journalism for a while because I hadn't been particularly proactive in the university journalistic scene. I definitely didn't have my own blog or, you know, tons of writing experience. And I thought that would work against me, but I eventually decided I should give it a go. And our alumni office got in touch and said there was this hedge fund magazine looking for people to do work experience over the summer. So I said, yes, please, and did 2 weeks there and then headed off to Paris to do my kind of first job post-uni, which was with a literary agency. And about halfway into that work, the hedge fund magazine called me up and said, we've got an opening. Would you be interested in a junior reporter's role? And I wasn't sure, to be quite honest, because I think, you know, when I first kind of flirted with the idea of journalism, I pictured myself as a, you know, a war reporter somewhere intrepid. And I called up a family friend of mine who worked for a newspaper and said, I've been offered this job. What do you think? And he said, you've got no experience. you're being offered a paid job in journalism. Are you mad? Of course you have to take it. So I did. And I actually completely fell in love with financial journalism.
Really cool. I don't think I even heard that sentence before from you or anybody else, falling in love with financial journalism. But having read that article you sent that Lionel Barber wrote, I can really see that, the kind of the mix of business and financial journalism and what important part that plays in like business in the UK and beyond.
Well, I think what I very rapidly learned, I mean, so when I was entering journalism, that was 2010. It was just after the financial crisis had hit. And the crisis really hit me personally on my year abroad because I had a student loan to fund my year in France, Germany and Switzerland. And suddenly it was worth, 20%, 30% less than what had been previously because of currency fluctuations. And that was the first time I suddenly realized, hang on a second, this stuff actually affects people and individuals. And, you know, I knew people who lost all their savings in ISAs because they'd put their money in an Icelandic savings vehicle. So very quickly, I realized that the old cliche, kind of money makes the world go around, was quite true. And the other thing is, as a reporter, the thing that is exhilarating and exciting is uncovering wrongdoing, exposing it and trying to right wrongs. And there's just ample opportunity to do that within financial journalism.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely true. So speaking of wrongdoing, I wanted to ask you about the President's Club. So I'm going to ask you to also tell me a bit about what the President's Club is or was. But I was going to say, so yeah, Christmas Day 2017, that you phoned me and I was sitting on my nan's staircase and you told me that you were doing this, planning to do this undercover investigation in January. Some of it sounded quite daunting, and also the FT doesn't do undercover investigations. That's not something they've normally worked in. But can you tell me why you decided to do it and how do you make it happen?
So I first heard of the President's Club in November 2017, and that was from a friend she does a bit of hostessing work on the side to make ends meet because she works in a transient area. And normally it's a very kind of normal thing to do. You know, plenty of university students do it. It's essentially working in a box at Wembley or Twickenham and taking executives to their seats and offering them a drink. And it's not very different to catering work or waitressing or bar work, except for sometimes the companies that hire the hostesses like them to wear slightly silly outfits, but that's fine. So this friend alerted me to the President's Club kind of in the wake of the Me Too movement because she had been told by plenty of other women who had worked as hostesses at a President's Club event that women at this event tended to be treated quite badly by those present. I didn't know much about it when she first said this, so I started doing my research. And in the weeks that followed, I quickly realised it is a male-only charity fundraiser that has been held every year at the Dorchester Hotel for the last 33 years. And despite the fact that it was attracting some of the biggest names in business, finance, entertainment, the media, etc., literally kind of household names, the event was completely under the radar. It had barely been written about. And also unusually for a charity event, because most charities do like to sing about their shout about fundraising activities from the rooftops. This one had almost deliberately tried to stay under the radar, which was another red flag. So I started doing my research and interviewing women who had previously worked at it. And yeah, the feedback was very clear. This was not a nice place for young women to be working at.
What sort of thing had you heard, or what sort of thing did you uncover on the night?
Well, so this is one of the problems. Because it's a male-only event, only open to a kind of wealthy, successful men, there was no way of either a male colleague going in and witnessing it for themselves, because they wouldn't have fit the calibre of the kind of person you needed to be. And I'm not sure they wanted any journalists there anyway. But also as a woman, there was no way I could have gone and seen it with my own eyes. So the only way to get a firm handle on what was actually happening at this event was to go in myself undercover, which is what I proposed to my editors late November, early December of 2017. And you're right in that the FT doesn't normally do undercover investigations. In fact, I think this might have been our first ever undercover plan. So there was, you know, some very detailed discussions within the FT about how to do it, how to make sure that I was safe on the night, and, you know, looking at the kind of public interest aspect of the story. And by mid-December, we got the go-ahead. What was actually happening on the night? It was initially, to start off with, I was incredibly nervous. So you get there and there's this kind of getting ready period. So I've got quite mixed views on it. Initially, it was quite boring. You had 4 hours of sitting around, kind of pampering yourself, trying to get ready for the event. There was a dress rehearsal for when all the women were meant to enter the ballroom where the evening was to be held, kind of crisscrossing each other on a stage while they played this song Power by Little Mix. Tallest women at the front, shortest at the back. Then you all had to go to your allocated tables and make conversation with the men, make sure they were happy, get them drinks when they wanted them.
Gross.
Yeah, I mean, from the outset, it was uncomfortable. You know, I can remember one vivid memory is having crossed over the stage, walking towards a table. Some of the guys had their phones out and were taking photos of the hostesses as they entered the room with a real kind of like, oh, get a load of this type attitude. Mm. And some of the women were really upset because they didn't know. We'd all been told in advance, you will be issued with a black dress to wear, but don't worry, it's nothing. It's just above the knee kind of thing. And in actual fact, the dresses were hideous. And a lot of women felt like they'd been kind of tricked into some kind of escort outfit. They were clearly uncomfortable with the men getting their phones out to snap them as they were walking past. And I guess one of the ironies was that all the women had to have their phones locked away for the evening, supposedly for their own safety. But clearly the same rules didn't apply to the men in the room. And then the evening proceeded. The first half of it was kind of acts on stage, dinner being served, men mostly sitting down, women mostly standing up or having to, you know, lean over or crouch at the men's feet to, in order to have those conversations. Some of the guys would stand up or offer the women their seat. As people got drunker, they'd be, you know, pulling women into their laps, holding their hands. You know, it initially wasn't that bad, but when the alcohol got flowing, it got progressively worse. And then by far and above the worst behaviour was at the so-called after party, which kicked off at around midnight, where something like 90% of the hostesses had been instructed to work at the after party. They weren't there voluntarily. And at that point, they no longer had a role. So, you know, there was a bar which functioned as any normal bar. You had to pay for your drinks. So it wasn't like the hostesses were there to go and fetch drinks for free. And what was the function of them being there? I've got no idea. There was a kind of a bank along one wall where, you know, by 1 a.m. they'd been working since 4 p.m. in the afternoon. They were clearly exhausted, and the men were behaving worse and worse. And, you know, I saw people being groped. I was groped. Some of the men had brought in a group of women who were widely assumed to be escorts. They're all wearing matching red outfits, you know, dancing with four of them simultaneously. And it was just, it was seedy, it was unpleasant, and it was depressing. I couldn't wait to be shot at the place.
Mm. Yeah, I remember some of the things that you told me about at the time, just kind of, you know, horrible comments, and just the whole thing sounded just so unbelievably outdated. And I know that at the time there was a kind of mixed response as to some people kind of saying, well, what's so shocking about that? Men have always been kind of leery bastards or whatever, or kind of outrage as to that behaviour doesn't have a place in our world anymore. But I was wondering, now that it's been a year since then, do you think much has changed since?
I think definitely some things have changed. So I think people are a lot more careful about what events they want to be associated with. And I also know I've met numerous people who they work in finance, but they're the trustee of various charities, or Helena Morrissey, the financier. She set up a charity in the wake of the closure of the President's Club. And I know people like that have been thinking very carefully about what kind of messages they convey at the events they run, from making sure that they have a good gender balance of staff working at those events, to making sure that they don't have a room full of white attendees served only by catering staff who are ethnic minorities. That, yeah, I think people are thinking about diversity and ensuring that there's a healthy mix of diversity in ways that they didn't think about it before. And I think that's a really good thing. What hasn't changed? I mean, people are still sexually harassed at work, and I don't know how you stamp that out. I think it's really good that people are feeling more emboldened than ever to call this stuff out. Mm-hmm. And we've definitely seen example after example after example of that, especially in kind of the banking sector. You know, women who were abused at the hands of a colleague as long as decades ago, getting in touch with that company's CEO and saying, you guys completely bungled this and I'm angry and I want you to resolve it. So, yeah, I think companies have had a bit of a wake-up call. But that's not just down to this story. It's down to a huge number of incredibly important Me Too stories that have come to light.
I think your article, your investigation, because it was more than one article, I think that did really have a tangible impact in the UK, because it wasn't people like Harvey Weinstein and people that are kind of the untouchables over in Hollywood. It was people that we recognise from British business that, you know, attended that event that was exposed and, yeah, brought closer to home. So another investigation you did not that long afterwards, a very impressive and thorough one, was into Sir Martin Sorrell. He used to head up the advertising network WPP and then sort of left in disgrace after these accusations came out about him, and now runs a different business. But I was wondering, what was it like in investigating, I guess, in a different field in advertising? And do you think you'd like to do more of this type of work in future?
I guess the short answer is it was difficult. So the Wall Street Journal published a story, I think in March or April of 2018, stating that he had stepped down and that there was a board investigation going into Martin Sorrell's conduct and use of company's funds. And they're very clear that this was not some kind of big fraud, but they weren't very clear about what exactly it was. So immediately, kind of every journalist in the city was thinking, what on earth has gone on here? Because this man built, you know, this is the company he built from scratch. And for him to leave so suddenly and with such little explanation was totally unexpected and a huge shock. So it took us about 3 months to build a picture of what had led to his departure. And it depends, obviously, who you're talking to. So, you know, some clients and board level people said that he was always very charming. And I'm sure that he can be very charming, but plenty of other people. The resounding feedback we had from dozens of sources was that people lower down the hierarchy within WPP were frequently treated quite badly by him. So there was a kind of bullying, toxic atmosphere for people like secretaries and drivers and so on. So, you know, shouting matches in the office, torrents of abuse over small mistakes, being signed off work, sick with stress, that kind of thing. So the funny thing was discussing that internally. I mean, it was almost like an open secret. People still bring up that story now with me and say, oh, yeah, he's always lovely with me. But God, I did really hear him give a complete bollocking to whoever. Everyone knew that that's how he behaved, but it was never called out or criticized. And it wasn't even questioned, is that an appropriate way for a CEO to be behaving? Mm. And I feel like that has also changed in the last 12 months. And we've seen it as well with Sir Philip Green, who has also been accused of certain things that I don't... So I don't want to go too much into the Philip Green accusations because I haven't been very close to that story. But from what I've read in other newspapers, some of it relates to alleged bullying of staff. So I take that as a really positive sign that I think, you know, as I've already said, that things have changed. What is considered appropriate conduct in the workplace, even by these kind of titans at the top of their industries, is completely different to what was considered acceptable 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And I think also through your reporting, not just through your investigations, but you've also previously looked into gender discrimination in fund management. You ended up being a kind of spokesperson for the Me Too era and even sort of uncovering workplace bullying and inappropriate behaviour. So would you have any advice for women listening to this? Any women that are experiencing discrimination in the workplace?
It's really difficult because fundamentally, people are always going to be worried about being perceived as a troublemaker if they do flag things internally. I do think that companies are more likely to than they have ever been listen to you and respond proactively and responsibly if you do flag a problem to them. So I don't think you should ever sit on anything. Always get the good, you know, get counsel from good friends, family, close colleagues, you know, people that you can trust. And, it depends what kind of company you work in. You know, in some companies, it depends if they're a giant, sprawling international corporation. It can really depend which department you're in or which office you're in. I don't know. What advice do I have if you're experiencing something horrible at work? Don't just sit back and put up with it. That's probably my best advice. So do something. And if that something is reporting it internally, then good on you for being so brave. If that thing is leaving the company because you can't bear it, also good on you for being so brave. But yeah, don't just sit back and tolerate it.
I think that's really good advice. And also you're one of my bravest friends, so it makes a lot of sense coming from you. I wanted to move things on to careers in journalism. I've always been kind of envious of your career, but I ended up in the kind of shinier, fluffier end of things in PR. But on the podcast theme of staying employable, how would you say that other journalists and writers can stay employable while it's quite a turbulent time for the media?
It's a good question. I mean, it's a question I ask myself. You know, what do I need to be doing now to make sure I've still got a job in 10 or 20 years?
Yeah, essentially, like, how can you sort of future-proof yourself in that industry?
I think it's difficult. There was a trend or a kind of flutter of this about 5 years ago, and everyone thought they needed coding skills. And, you know, I know some people who went off and retrained and got coding skills. And especially in journalism, there was this real obsession with data journalism. I still also really fundamentally believe in the kind of old-fashioned basics of journalism, which is you get your best stories from talking to people. Yeah, there are different schools of what makes a good journalist. Some people think you don't even need to be a good writer. You just need to be able to
really
be excellent at getting tips. Yeah, some people are infamous or famous for being crap writers, but delivering the goods, i.e. scoop after scoop after scoop, and it's down to the editors to polish that information into a killer story. Other people are incredible writers and they can do so much with so little. So they've got one snippet of a fact and they can just turn that into a front page story time after time. And so it's really hard to say you need that one skill. So I can't even say you need to be a great writer. I mean, obviously that is a huge help. But yeah, I'm going to go back to what I said at the beginning. I think you just need to be really proactive about talking to people, listen to your instincts. So sometimes I've had this in the past where, say I'm supposed to be meeting the CEO of a company and that CEO has cancelled on me two or three times in the space of 2 weeks. And I've kind of, I felt like, oh, that's a bit odd, but I've not put two and two together, and then 3 weeks later, CEO is stepping down, or, you know, there's some kind of scandal involving that company, and then you're like, oh, of course. So it's just, you know, being alive to stuff going on around you. And yeah, I guess this is all more for news reporting, though. And I guess if you're not in the sector, you know, if you're trying to break into journalism, never, ever turn down an opportunity, I think, would be my best advice. So, and actually, this is something you've always been really good at in your career. I've always thought you'd make a good journalist because you're so bold about, you know, requesting meetings and approaching people and saying, you know, will you come and do this with me or will you come and do that? And, you know, some journalists, I've seen this as well, they kind of hide behind their computers or behind their email inboxes, and they don't actively go out and approach people and meet people all the time. And that's definitely something you need to have and do. And if you're offered work experience, if, you know, it doesn't matter if it's on a potato magazine or a hedge fund magazine or, you know, something much more exciting or a kind of fashion mag, all of that is relevant experience. So grab it and learn from it.
For the record, there is such thing as a potato magazine, isn't there? I think it's like a
Potato Weekly?
Yeah, yeah. Something like that. There's a lot of slightly weird niche trade magazines around.
But they're an amazing place to learn the trade.
Yeah.
You know, and I think if I'd have started off on a potato magazine, I would have been breaking scoops about the potato market and crisps and God knows what else. And hopefully, you know, I could have grown in that way. So I think, yeah, never, ever turn down an opportunity.
Crisps reporter would be kind of like your...
dream job?
Alternative.
I am obsessed with crisps, correct.
Do you have any other thoughts on how people breaking into the industry can get noticed initially, if you haven't already got experience?
It's hard, but, you know, I don't recruit, so it's quite difficult for me to comment on that. I think, you know, I have been part of recruitment processes in the past, and it does help if, I mean, I didn't have this, so I feel like I'm being hypocritical by saying it. It does help if you have some writing experience, which comes back to my point of accepting, you know, any opportunity that, if, you know, if you've written for your university magazine or, you know, you've done theatre reviews or done work experience wherever, or, you know, you've done a completely different career, but within that job, you sought out writing type roles. All of that will catch the eye of someone looking to hire. So that's all helpful. If you don't have any of that, you know, monitor work experience placements and try and get yourself a couple.
I went back to my old school last night to be part of a careers talk, and a couple of girls at the end came to ask me about the podcast and say, like, how can we get into that? And I was saying, I haven't got like a gateway into it. I just kind of just did it myself, which doesn't mean I'm particularly skilled at it. But basically, we ended up discussing maybe they could do like a one-off or just sort of two off like episodes of a podcast, because they're both interested in working in advertising. I was saying, well, why don't you do something like record a conversation between you guys talking about this year's Christmas ads and what you thought of them and kind of rating them and edit that down so it's quite polished, you know, use GarageBand on your Mac or like Audacity on Windows, whatever. And then like send that to a few ad agencies and say, I'm really interested in advertising. Can I get a couple of, you know, like a week's work experience or whatever? Yeah, sort of willingness to make stuff to show that you care about being in there, like being in that industry.
Yeah, I think it definitely helps that you can prove that you've done some writing. So I say I was a hypocrite and I had no experience. In most of the roles I had done, there was an element of writing and I could prove that. So I'd done, an internship as a translator in Switzerland. A lot of that was writing. I'd done an internship with a theatre festival in Berlin. And the stuff I'd really enjoyed doing that was the kind of marketing material, as well as meeting all the actors and the performers who are coming and going, and the kind of face-to-face contact. So I think I picked up snippets of experience in other roles, which I could say, you know, I've done writing in a professional setting and here's the evidence, and I really enjoyed it. The other thing I'd done was publishing, and I did 3 months with a French publishing house and had to write a lot of the blurbs for the books. And that was one of the funnest bits of the job. You know, how do you summarize a 300-page book into a paragraph on the back and keep it interesting?
I'm kind of amazed that you managed to do that in another language. I would struggle.
I was
to
in
do
the
that.
English language department of a French publishing house.
Thank God.
But I did have to read a lot of stuff in French. I was helping with books being translated from French into English. And I was doing similar stuff when I moved to the literary agency after university.
You had actually done quite a lot by the time you did land in journalism. So speaking of where journalism might end up, I think you might know that I ask everybody on here where they think the future of their industry is going, because 30 years ago we had boom and bust time of the 80s, kind of like we do now, and I feel that we used hairspray and big shoulder pads to get ourselves out of a mess. But do you want to paint me a picture of where you think things could be 30 years from now in terms of journalism? Because things like technology stand to make a massive impact on it.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of debate as to whether we will still have print newspapers or not. I'm on the fence on that one. I think that definitely people like holding something in their hands. And again, maybe I'm old fashioned, but I've not been converted to Kindles. I still like to have a physical book in my hands. That said, I don't really read print newspapers. I probably shouldn't say that, but I tend to read my stuff on my phone or on my computer at work. That said, I do like to read it on the weekend. So I think weekend newspapers definitely still have a place. And yeah, I don't know. I'm as fascinated as anyone else to see whether we still have printed daily newspapers in 30 years' time. So that's where one of the big debates lies. Other people, you know, there's this fear of kind of robots and automation and whether journalists will become defunct as AI takes over. I think we've already seen some of the early beginnings of that. So I think it was Bloomberg, but I could be wrong. I think developed a bot that could basically write up company earnings. So it could read an earnings report and write an article off the back of that.
Wow.
It wasn't perfect because it might not be able to spot things like, you know, this is the first time ever that X has happened, or, you know, this is the biggest price jump in two decades, or, you know, that kind of comparative analysis at that time it didn't have. However, I'm sure it can be built. So I think some elements of journalism could definitely be automated, but the traditional stuff of getting good scoops and writing in a beautiful, attention-grabbing way, I don't think that can ever be done by a robot. So I'm still optimistic that not all journalists will be driven out of their jobs in 30 years' time.
Yeah, thank you. So lastly, where can people find you?
So I'm on Twitter as @miss_marriage, which is my surname. That's probably the best place to find me.
I remember you used to get a lot. Well, do you still get a lot of weird stuff on Twitter? So because you've got marriage in your name?
Yeah, I actually just wrote an article about elitist, or if you want to be kind, exclusive dating apps. And there are lots of comments underneath that about, isn't it ridiculous? This article has been written by someone with a surname called Marriage. So yeah, I do still get comments about my surname. And no, I'm not married. yeah, an irony which will probably follow me around.
Well, thank you so much for today. I've really, really enjoyed it. And I think listeners will get a lot out of it. So thanks, Mats.
Thanks for having me.
This has been Powersuit Podcast, and I've been your host, Lauren Ingram. Please do us a massive favour and give us a rating on iTunes so that more people can find the podcast. I hope you've had a great Christmas break, and thank you for listening.